recording, and I do here on my little other device. And what I'd like to do is first to welcome, hello, Neil Pearson.
Pearson, yeah.
And today is the 21st of April, and we're talking in preparation for the book Yoga Radicals, Stories of Pioneers in the Yoga Innovation World, to be published by Singing Dragon Press. And before the questions arise, Neil, let's take some time together to create some sacred space. We've already talked about the land that you are sitting near and in. I told you about where I am, but let's invite in just a little silence and also guidance, so that as we ground here together, to invite all the guides, all the angels, all the helpers that might be interested to be enlisted. So this is a welcoming of all the teachers, all the traditions, and that which is yet to be born. So this work is about tending and mending this liminal space, this place of the in-between, moving from me to we, so that our personal journeys as yogis, as meditators, as holders of traditions, actually opens us to give to others for the benefit of our collective identity formation. So adding any words that you'd like to resonate here in this first moment. And then just maybe doing a little wiggle, waggle, find that spine, find that connection to what is above and what is below and what is all around. And so thank you again. I deeply appreciate your willingness to play, to join into this process. Thanks, and I also just mentioned my gratitude to the Presidency Institute and also to the IAYT, because they've basically been inviting me to continue to move forward with this. And Singing Dragon. So first question, if it's true that we're working from this model that invites 5 points, one which is the intention, the second, and these are not in order, which invites this quality, let's call it the neuroception, of listening to the universe, and then this quality of inviting others, the core team, and then this other, finding a place or space, a landing strip for the idea and the people to actually come into form together, and then to really learn again and again and again through this iterations, through trying by doing, failing fast.
Yeah.
So those are the 5 points that we'll be covering. But okay. I always want to first, it's really a respect of the spark, and to know that as you ground in your own personal experience from an embodied presence perspective, to remember the project and the process that you want to stay connected to in our conversation, so that it has some consistency, some coherence.
Yeah.
So this is the first question about what was this initiation or invocation, where the spark actually landed in your consciousness that there was a project to be born?
Wow. I guess in terms of the project to be born, we could say it was related to the book that Marlissa and Shelley and I have written around yoga and science and pain care. But I think the spark and the project were very different at the beginning. The spark was working as a physical therapist, you know, in the first, you know, years of my work, so in the mid 80s, and recognizing that the stories that the people I was working with, they're stories of their experience, right? They're, you know, just to clarify, it's the person's experience of having pain. And so I'm going to call that story, and I don't mean to invalidate it, but it is still a story. This story was so different from what I learned in school. And the spark really came because I you know, it's one of those things, where did this come from? This idea that maybe what my patients were telling me was a more valid explanation of what was happening than what I learned in school. And in part, I had some advantage of that because we really hadn't talked a lot about pain in school. And at the time, there really weren't a whole, there weren't textbooks that I could turn to. And, you know, basically the discussion of physical therapy was that pain had to do with tissue damage, and that if there was still pain, there was still tissue damage, right? It was very much of this, these two things were so linked together like this. And, but the stories that patients were telling me didn't match with that. And it made me question what I'd learned, and actually what it did was it made me curious to figure this out. And that's really where, for me, where it all began is there's this thing that I'm asked, being asked to treat, you know. Right, really, that was the language, right? We treat pain, we don't treat people, was sort of the physical therapy sort of idea. And so I really, that's really where the spark began. And over years of working with people and then finding, finding contemplative practice first, and then finding yoga as another contemplative practice. And then, you know, spending most of my career working with people who have complex chronic pain problems, while at the same time the science was expanding. Right. And so along the path, really, to say where the next big piece happened was as I started to practice yoga, and I want to make it clear, not asana, but I really had the wonderful fortune of running into yoga teachers who were very much about teaching Raja yoga right at the very beginning. So I didn't really know that there was all this other stuff going on out there. And then realizing at that point, because at that point I was working in a multidisciplinary pain management center. And just to me, that was, this is amazing. It's like all this stuff that we're doing within yoga feels like the same stuff that we're trying to do in pain management. And so that would have been like late 1990s. And of course, since then, the science has really expanded from there. And so over the years, what we've done is put together some courses and started to teach within yoga therapy training programs more about pain, more about pain care, and how we can use yoga therapy for it. And then developing, you know, it's sort of this, been this expanding, as you said, this iterative process of, you know, started teaching retreats for people with pain. And then started to have yoga teachers and healthcare professionals saying they wanted to come. And at the first, I was like, no, it's not for you. This isn't for me to teach you how to do this. This is for me to share this with people in pain. But then realizing that there was a need for sharing this idea with other yoga therapists as well. And sort of quick sort of where it came from. But I think that's the...
Yeah. I'm listening in. And what I might do from time to time is to ask a further question from what we're naming the generative field. So what I heard you say from this deeper quality of listening, Neil, was that as your practice deepened and you began to compare and contrast what your school, your formal education, mm-hmm. had named as the way pain was handled, let's call it, that there was this shift as you began to listen to the stories of the people you were working with. And so I'm wanting to go a little bit deeper on the how you sensed their stories as it compared or didn't to your own development of your personal practice. What was awakening in you that invited that deeper listening? Not just that it was different, but that there was some other quality of sensory-based knowing that began to perhaps awaken in you?
Well, that's a great question, because I think it actually came more from, it wasn't my personal practice that was deepening and letting this happen over here, it was the practice of actually listening to not to me, right, and not listening so much to the world, but to listening to the person right in front of me. That's deeper listening there. And actually, I'd never thought of it before as a practice, but that really is where I went, was the practice of sitting with the person and listening to their story. And I think I had the blessing to be able to be in places where I had time to listen to the story. Because a lot, I'm sure you recognize a lot of physical therapy doesn't, because it's so fast. But the situations I ended up in allowed that. But it wasn't sort of a formal contemplative practice or a yoga practice that sort of moved me to listen more. It was actually the practice of listening. It really, initially sparked by this curiosity of, really, how could people be so wrong, right? This sort of this idea. And it was the idea is that they probably aren't, right? Yeah. So I'm probably wrong. And and I think that's as in over the years of talking with people in psychology and talking with people in yoga therapy, sometimes there have been some individuals said, that's not really the way most of us think. So this idea that we sort of have this worldview, this is how the world works. We've been taught that through experience, and people, given us information, and then somebody comes along and their experience doesn't fit in your worldview. Apparently what we mostly do is we decide the person's just an outlier. We believe the person, but they're different from everybody. And we just decide they don't fit with what I think. And so I can't challenge what I think. I'm going to just say they're someone else. And for some reason I kept on wondering whether this worldview idea had some flaws or some imprecisions, right? And really over the years, I think that's what I've seen is that it's not that it's wrong. It's that, people gave me this foundation that I need to learn from, it need to evolve and need to recognize it, that it's more about it being imprecise than it being, flawed or wrong, I think. But it really was the listening part.
Okay. So as we massage the way in which the field of your awareness began to involve others and began to involve experiments, the retreats that you mentioned, the interest that others had around something that was being born, right? So this organic quality of there being a something to tend and mend and nurture and ask questions of, have a relationship with, that quality of resonance, right? That kept moving you in. Mm-hmm. The question around who else got interested. It's the old classic, who were the stakeholders that you engaged to help move your project forward? But more importantly, your particular way in which the resonance helped you ask questions. Not that you were wrong or they were wrong, but there was something in the middle that began to open up. This kind of, that it's kind of the analogy of the spacious awareness place, mm-hmm. but lifting it up into more of a systems orientation.
Right. And, I haven't really thought about it in that perspective, but I would say that the catalyst there was the field of yoga. So within medicine, medicine is a broad healthcare medicine, there was this, this attempt to talk about a biopsychosocial view, and which really is part of the sort of the solution around this or the understanding of it, is to sort of move in that direction to understand that. And obviously we need to evolve past it. But within that world, I could talk to other healthcare people about this, but it was still fragmented. It was still, we talked about the biomedical and we talked about the psychological. Actually, we rarely talked about the social. Occasionally we talked a little bit about that. But then once I came to the yoga world and started to learn, learn this practice. So, the initial teachers I had, and then the wonderful teacher I ended up in yoga teacher training, who, the reason I took her training, because it was about yoga philosophy and yoga teaching, you know, as a physical therapist, I didn't feel compelled to go learn how to tell people how to move their body in asana. I sort of had a good understanding of that. So I finally found someone who is this amazing teacher. Her name's Muggs McConnell. And she just really opened this door. And all of a sudden it was like, hey, I've got a language here. And I've got people who understand this, like people with whom I can talk about the integration of these things rather than staying in, you know, this wonderfully dualistic view, right? You know, and you know, staying, I think actually Seth Beer is the first person I ever heard say, you know, we experience the world from, we're non-dualistic entities experiencing the world from dualism, something like that. I think he was either the first person I heard say it. It's possible other people said, and I never really heard it, but it's like, that's where I was. And it was frustrating to be in a place that didn't really talk about how it was all fit together. And then the yoga world, it's part of yoga teaching. So the door is open to start. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That's so helpful. I just want us to remember the readers, many of whom will be early yoga students or PTs or behavioral health people who hadn't yet traversed this blended path mm-hmm. that's beginning to happen in community care, in embodied practice mm-hmm. environments, where the impact of the wisdom traditions, which you just so beautifully spoke about as you deepened your understanding from the non-scientific basis, and then somehow this marriage, this blending, you mentioned it, we're living dualistically, yet we are in a non-dual state. So that's basically the generative field set of inquiry questions. How might we, as we co-initiate now into some new shared understanding, right? You said that you hadn't thought yet about the social impact of the way the science and the philosophy began to merge. But now we're moving toward other people who might also have a heart-mind coherence, mm-hmm. where through their own personal experience, through group activities, through projects, retreats, that something new began to emerge. So this is this moment of something being let go and something actually emerging, something, I just call it the new zone. And so can you remember when that person, that place, that set of circumstances was more the enabling criteria, let's call it, of something to truly land in a different way, not just an idea or an appreciation or increased awareness that you're mentioning, but something that actually could be shared, offered to others? Mm. Is there one? It might not be in your case.
No, I think there are two, actually. The first one would absolutely be that at the end of the yoga classes that I started in Vancouver, it's a place called The Wandering Yogi. And it was a husband and wife ran it. And there was an opportunity at the end of the class, we would sit down and we'd have tea and we would talk. And what I realized was that this felt like home in a way that the conversation was inquisitive and it was candid. And, you know, it just was this sharing of these ideas of experiences during the class. We just like talk about that stuff. And I'd never experienced that openness in that, you know, openness to be able to just talk about your experience in from anything actually in life. You know, it reminded me of one of the things it really reminded me of was when I was working in the hospitals, I worked in intensive care, both neonatal intensive care, but also adult trauma intensive care. And it reminded me a lot of the language of the palliative care workers. Mm-hmm. So this hospital was in Sudbury, Ontario, and the gray nuns had been associated with starting the hospital and they'd stayed affiliated with it. And they essentially were the holders of wisdom and compassion and would take take care of people in the worst of possible times, both the staff and the patients there. And it reminded me of their language.
Mm.
And what their language and their love and their openness, right, and acceptance. But the other place was really once again when I was the opportunity to just speak freely about ideas and to share them in much more deep way when I was doing the yoga philosophy training. And once again, when you said it, what it reminded me of both times, it actually felt like this is who I am. This is what I want to do. Right. This is where I feel good. You know, that's not the same kind of feeling that I've had in, you know, in the academic world or in the even in the healthcare world. Most of the times there's not an openness, because there's right. I think one of the biggest things around healthcare is the need to be right and to know is so, you know, that's what we're all trained to be and do. Right.
So in this journey of the Presencing Institute, you're perfectly enabling me to give just a little moment of shaping. Mm-hmm. If the wisdom traditions actually are already always alive in us.
Mm-hmm.
And through some particular circumstances, we come in contact with the enabling conditions,
mm-hmm.
right? A teacher, a place, your memory of the nuns back in the Ontario time, that recognition, this is a deeply an old spiritual principle, that there's a recognition, which is right before you said, this is where home is. This is where I know that I am here. We're beginning to call that action confidence. And so that enabling kind of criteria, when we tack it on to a leadership model,
mm-hmm.
begins to invite the questions, well, what are the qualities of the being home, and then knowing what I'm supposed to do next? So those would be you reflecting now again, you know, for the benefit of the readers, what were the qualities that began to awaken in you that were recognizable in others, by others, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. I'm struggling with that one a little bit.
But you said it about the nuns. They carried it and they supported. So find that in you, because it's no different. That intention and their attention on holding that intention through their vows, as many of the wisdom holders have done in the more formal practice environments, right? The nuns, the ashrams, the monks. But now as things, you know, we call the secularization, right? That's just the social way. But as we have individual experiences, the reflective quality of you coming home
mm-hmm.
is something that's recognizable as a trait, as a characteristic. And maybe we would just want to leave it as a space for mm-hmm. people to sense into as they read your story. Yeah. And that's okay. It doesn't have to be in language. It could just be in a shape or a memory or an image, a bhavana of some sort, gesture.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to love. Like there is this, you know, yeah, really it's love. It's acceptance. It's compassion. It's feeling like we're in this together. Which is it's the same thing I felt when I met my wife. Right. So I'm actually married to a Swami. this is, you know, what it's all about. But I think that was the point of, or that was the experience that I had. I don't know that it was a characteristic that other people saw in me so much, but my experience was that, this is what life is about.
Okay.
And I know in the midst of there, you also asked about, you know, the moving forward, where it guided you to. And to me, that's one of the most fascinating things, is because I don't think I've ever had sort of a revelation of, here's where I am, and that's where I need to go. Somehow it just feels like it's evolved. It's just sort of more happened. I'm not a person who sort of planned, okay, well, if I've got this, I should do this, and this is what I want to do in 5 or 10 years. I know what I want to help people. But in terms of how to share what I've learned and help other people, that seems to have, it really just seems to have evolved more by what the world is ready for, in a way.
Right. Okay, so I'll get concrete here so that we can back into the scaffolding of this emergent belief that you just so beautifully described. It's not that I had an idea about what I want, is what I heard you say from just a pretty practical perspective, but that if my forearm here were your spine, and that all that came before is what you ground in, and that, as you mentioned, it's all about love, and you have a personal relationship that clearly supports your request to offer whatever it is that you're offering. For the readers now, can you trace back, even if it's a teaching, a sutra, one of those important things that you might return to on a regular basis in order to scaffold or to further beef up or create more strength in the who you are as you lean in to your projects, to your love, to your students, your words, your being?
I can't think of a specific instance, but in terms of it was a recognition of reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
The giving back piece, it's hard to separate that out from just, I think one of the other fascinating things about yoga was that there was this language that said, what we do for others is really, really important. You know, the language of karma yoga. I mean, it's sort of what I believe, but I never really knew how to talk about it before.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the when you talk about sort of, you know, the what came along to help me to move forward with this was the recognition of giving back is what I, giving back is the right thing to do. I have a hard time with the wording around that, but that it is about sharing with others. As much as about receiving from others, it's about, you know, giving out.
Okay. Yeah. So let's just look at the elements that we're pointing to. The directionality is what I'm listening into. Because it's similar to what my question was around what others saw in you. So let's just zoom out to the perimeter here on this reciprocal, non-dual capacity that we have to shift the quality of our awareness,
right,
into different slices and dices of reality, right? Our current moment here, the moment that's going to come after we finish, the what came before, and that it's recognizable. Mm-hmm. This is the lifting up from the liminal field of something that we sometimes just wait for it to be an accident, you know, of some gift of God or a moment of grace. That too, right? And there's a cultivation that, in a leadership perspective, the lens through which I'm trying to create some space for people to land. And it's just about stringing the pearls a little bit further along in the developmental process where the transformational reality becomes the ordinary moment.
Mm-hmm.
We call this in search of the miraculous as the way we wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the expectation, that the wind blows and we're listening. Mm-hmm. And spirit, however you want to know it, soul, capacity. Mm-hmm. The wind is picking up here. begins to allow us to invite a further articulation, right? This is the alchemical aspect of the subtle awareness. So I'm just wanting to create space in our time together. And mm-hmm. it doesn't need an answer. I just am hearing it from your language. And so I'm trying to fish out a little more.
I think what people told me, you know, when I think back to what people told me, was that there's a few things that I've listened to. One is that it was about my behavior. It was what they were seeing, experiencing, was how I was in myself, and how that was so important to my ability to help other people. As it wasn't just talk, it was, you know, just the sense people got from me. I think another thing around it was people, it's interesting, as a physical therapist, sometimes people at the end of it would be sort of, at the end of treatment, would be so exuberant with their thanks. And really what I learned over, you know, time was to say to people, you know, it's really not about me. It's about, you know, you're the one that's done the work here. I've guided you in it. You've done the work. And it's funny, this happened a few years ago. This one woman just touched my arm. And when I said that, and she says, yeah, you'll figure it out, or something like that. Right. And it was something that at the time I didn't think a lot of, because there was another patient coming in. But then it struck me later as like, I've been so wrong about this. It is about me. Right. So yes, the person's done the work. But what this person is telling me is that for whatever it was, you know, yes, they know they did the work, but there was something about me in the way that I work with them. And I'm not specifically saying about me as an individual, as in my ego, just something I was able to offer to them that actually allowed them to succeed where they hadn't been able to succeed before. And I really don't think that that's something, like I say, I don't think that that's something unique to me. I really think it has more to do with the love piece again. The one other thing around this is that one of the things, when I was teaching therapeutic yoga classes, I had people coming up to me, and this happened a bunch of times, people saying, you know, before I came here, I was in physical therapy and I was always trying to get better. And I was trying to get better. And what I found here is peace. You know, you've offered me a place where I actually found a place to stop fighting so much, stop struggling so much. And I found that sense of peace. And to me, each of those things sort of fits together of what was I able to, what did people see in me, or what was I able to offer them? Somehow I was able to offer them a sense of hope and optimism validation and empowerment, and, you know, all those things that are so important to so important once we start to practice yoga or other contemplative.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. So the picture that I receive as I listen to you in that reflection does land in this conceptual frame of reciprocity, which seems to be a real informing conceptual frame for you. And from a spiritual or esoteric perspective, there's this gift of generosity mm-hmm. that sometimes isn't well understood. It's just kind of looked at as just something. Mm-hmm. And when we open our awareness to the networking of all these nervous systems, particularly now, mm-hmm. and the where we have to go in order to adapt to this ever-changing world, it occurs to me, as you were speaking about your embodied presence as being one of those attributes and the way you were in yourself, right? Those are actual things that we study and help people learn how to hold on to more consistently in leadership development circles for the benefit of the teams that they work with, for the benefit of the organizations, blah, 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 on it goes. And so if the opportunity here through these stories is for a leadership model to begin to emerge, right? That's my hoped for outcome. These practices of unique embodied presence, not from a theory, not from a framework, but from, as we say in behavioral health, the lived experience of maybe just a mature, generous person. Doesn't have to be a swami, a yogi, a PhD, and anybody, but someone who stepped in. And so I'd like just to shift, because we've been in the zone of learning by doing. Right? You've been telling me the story of how it emerged for you, who came in, how you did it. And now when I got into the more investigatory thing with, well, what is it about you? This very interesting and very specific deference. So I want to name that from the perspective of sacred time. And to find ways to help readers understand the unique experience of how sacred time comes in through practice, through trial by error, and through some trust. So could you talk a little bit, Neil, about as these new projects that were part of your followership of this sacred journey that we're investigating and asking questions of, what else accompanied you? You've mentioned love, you've mentioned the courage, you've mentioned the embodied presence. And thinking again about trying by doing things. And sometimes it helps to think about a really challenging time and where that breakthrough was, to identify some of these other helpers for people who are also in transition. Leadership is a movement through transitional stages.
Right. Well, I think there's some pieces in there that are part of what made this happen that I want to say. One is that the listening thing stuck. It seems to be it's always... Right. That's really, you know, in terms of leadership, I think that's super important to be able to listen, you know, deeply listen. And I also think, you know, to be able to do that, we need to know how to hold space. We need to have some experience that, you know, really lands hard or lands well or completely this idea that that it's not our job to fix other people. It's not our job always to fix this thing that's going on. It's our job often our job is to just really hold space, be there, listen to what the person's saying, and then work with them in the end to find a solution. And I think that's part of a big part of my evolution is to be there, right? And I think that's difficult, definitely in terms of the yoga therapy, right? We want to be the expert. We want to be the person who's going to, you know, lead the person forward. And often to me, one of the interesting things is that we need to, in terms of practicality, I would say as leaders, what we need to do, or as yoga therapists, what we need to do is there are times when we need to sit at the feet of our this other person, whether patient, client, whatever name we're giving, right? So we need to sit at their feet, they're the expert. And we also need to be able to sit, we also need to be in a place where they're sitting at our feet and we're okay with that. And we also need to be in that place where we are colleagues, brainstormers, co-workers together. And I think, you know, in terms of leadership, I think this is a thing that's often missing when I think of how I was taught. Because I was taught that I'm the expert. I have this knowledge. You don't have it. you know, so I'm always here. And I think that's another thing that people have seen in me. And I think that it's something that I've learned over a long period of time in this process of to succeed when things are complex. It's the, the whole idea is, you know, people often talk about yoga making us more flexible. To me, that word should be more just this idea of adaptable, and the importance of being able to adapt to the person that we're with to be able to serve them best. Mm-hmm. Because we can serve them best by many different ways, but most of us are taught that we always need to be this particular way. Mm-hmm. As in, you know, the patient-centered goal setting that I hear people talking about, which teaches a lot of people that you are always there, right? Unfortunately, people get taught that rather than recognizing that this is saying, no, that's one of the ways to do this, but you still have expertise that the other person doesn't have, and they have expertise that you don't have. So it's not just being there. It's this, you know, it's almost like physiological resilience, right?
Yeah.
You're most healthy when things can vary up and down a lot, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. I think leaders were most effective when we can morph to the situation that's happening in front of us rather than being same all the time.
Okay. So that fluidity or that adaptability, that resiliency really is what I hear you also opening in terms of the field of inquiry. And then the relationship between the one who apparently holds the information, but actually it's the body of the person that holds the information. And how do we actually interact with the intelligence of that other body and their adaptability or not in that moment of time? And so as we kind of wind down here for these last few minutes, let's just take a moment to connect back in, remembering that we started with this question of the spark, and then we kind of danced around these many networks of knowings, I'll call them, around your developmental journey, the people, the places, how you've understood yourself as a change maker. Without having a serious I'm gonna kind of approach, you know, and so I just want to name that as a quality of this deeper capacity of field intelligence, resonant intelligence, just like you spoke about the individual body having the information, you might have training, but as we imagine what it might actually be in a world where we share the collective resources of the ecosystem, and that we are enacting as individuals, mm-hmm. because we are in these bodies, and we have this opportunity to respond to this other intelligence. I called it that timeless sacred time. So as we end, what is it, as you sense into the boundary of your own capacity now, it's like gently nudging the container of the who you are right now. Can you peek around the corner or peek over the side? It's like bending time a little bit, you know, or the end of a rainbow, you know, just that quality of what's not quite seen. Do you have a sense of it? Because what I've heard you tap into so much was a sensory intelligence, not a verbal, not a cognitive, but this more coherent place. And so from that place, let's see what we can create for our ending moment here.
I've got a sense of it. I've been thinking about it a lot. Is this the idea of, you know, really of where do I go from here? So to me, there's a couple options. There's the option of just continuing on doing what I'm doing, and you know, the people who are interested in this, you know, the work that I do around pain care and yoga is just, you know, keep on letting people know that I'm here, and then they can come, whether it's virtual coming or whether it's actually, you know, they come and do it. Or, I mean, the that's what I really like to do, right?
Okay.
and to continue to share out, right? But what there's this other thing of you know, do I work on growing this because I think it's so important? Do I actually, you know, take it, decide that my task is to take it, to try to take it more to the world, which is I still don't know if that's the right path to take, and which is interesting because I guess in terms of up until now, I would say everything has been more an evolution than a making decision of what path I'm going to take next. Mm-hmm. And I actually feel at this point that I sort of need to make a decision, because the thing that would serve me the best would be to not struggle, not fight around this, not try to push. In part because it's so hard to try to push it out to the world more without people thinking that you're saying that they're wrong. And that's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that, can we evolve this? Can we take the yoga teaching around pain? Yoga teaching says this is it, but we're continuing within yoga to treat pain as if it's something that doesn't fit the rules of all the other yoga teaching, which I really find odd. And I really want to try to get people to understand that so that we can create less fear in our students and we can get them to be more resilient and challenge themselves. But that actually takes a certain amount of, you know, that requires stepping into conflict. That requires putting in more effort. That requires having less time to enjoy the world and the people that I'm around. And, you know, I've done, within the physiotherapy world in Canada, I think that I've done a lot to change the physiotherapy world around pain and pain care and science. So, you know, there's this, do I want to step into that same thing? Do I want to step in and continue to try to push this? Or would it serve me more to step back and just see patients on my own here? And right? So I don't know. I just don't know which direction.
So beautifully articulated about the sacred threshold moment. Mm-hmm. Right. I just make a little shape around this doorway that you kind of leaned into and then leaned out of and then choked a little bit. And I just want to name that this moment is one that so many share. Mm-hmm. And so the scaffolding of our practices and then the call into something that isn't yet known is our moment. So I just, you know, I'm going to bow here and hand on heart as we learn that the stillness as well as the movement is part of this non-dual reality. And so time has stopped at a certain way. As one of my students in Jamaica said to me, he said, you know, Allie, people didn't understand that the Mayan calendar really did end and we're still all reorienting. And so if we really zoom out to the bigger picture, as we try and find our identities, as the world changes, these stories are the critical seeds of the future, Neil. This beautiful last riff. And I don't know if you noticed, but your whole spine opened and your arms began to move as you started to describe your moment. So I just.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this feels to me very much like about 4 years ago when I got so busy with all this other teaching that I had to make a decision to stop seeing patients like a regular. I was still seeing patients 3 days a week and I needed to make the decision for me. Right.
Yeah.
The thing that has taught me more than anything in my life, right? You know, the biggest teachers I've had are the patients I've seen. And it was funny because the losing my voice, that's the very first time I tried to say it. And probably for weeks after that, every single time I tried to say it, it got caught in my throat. It just like this, oh my God, this is so important. This is such a like an important step for me to take. I almost, you know, the fear of the unknown. Is it really the right choice to make? Anyway, yeah, that's definitely where I feel like I am right now. And I think everything that's happening right now is, is just adding more
to
figure this out.
Right. So as we shift and morph and unburden and unbind, it's beautiful to witness in each of these stories that I feel so honored to listen to. And I thank you, Neil, for being so transparent and visible.
Thank you for that guidance. That was wonderful.
So I'm going to turn off the recording, and I will be in touch about a few other details. The manuscript isn't due until September, so there's quite a bit of spaciousness.
Well, that's great. Well, all the best with writing it. It's another piece that I found that I don't think I'm ever going to write a textbook again, but definitely writing is something that's, because story is so important. But anyway.
Thank you so much.
Great spending time with you. You have a wonderful day.
Bye for now.
Bye.